In the great alphabetical book of life, E is for Eohippus's episode. And we know Eohippus is the oldest horse-like animal ever. Episode is an animal that lives on the surface of another animal, whether parasitical or commensally. For your information, commensally is an adverb characterized by eating at the same table or living together for mutual benefit. Inventive interpretations run wild inside the pages of Daedal Doodle and in the mind of the Jim Thorpe Renaissance man, the painter, the artist exceptional, the teacher extraordinaire, and poet exceptional. Letters become words, words become phrases, and phrases become something totally unexpected. Vain snails, a small-headed monster looking for love, subatomic sheep, and a prehistoric horse with a dental hygienist captivates the readers in illustrations, quirky words, and illuminating definitions. The exhibition of the book, Daedal Doodle, An Extraordinary Journey Through the Alphabet, can be found at the Allentown Art Museum June the 3rd through September 9th. This is WDIY Allentown, and I remain George Miller, along with my co-host and wife, Kate Scuffle. Our guest tonight, the quadlibetical, that is, not confined to a particular subject, discussed pleasure for curiosity and entertainment, is artist and philosopher Victor Snavin. Welcome.
Thank you, George. It's quite the introduction. I also play a doctor on TV.
Oh, do you really? Yeah. I didn't know that. How did Daedal Doodle really come to be?
Well, there's a couple of stories, and it happened at different times in my life. But let's see. When my oldest daughter was 3 years old, I was reading many, many ABC books. And simultaneously, she was calling me Acorn Daddy, where she would say Acorn Refrigerator or Acorn Car. And everything was prefaced with the word acorn. And I don't know, I guess if you're 2 feet tall, acorns are bigger than if you're 6 feet tall.
True.
And short story is, because we're only here for 24 minutes, not 24 hours, I decided to make an ABC book for her. And the first page in the book was going to be Anti-Gravity Acorn. And so the second page in the book was going to be what? And I didn't know where to go. So I went to the dictionary, which is actually my old friend, and I started looking up words that I thought sounded cool. I have I don't know if you remember Lord Buckley.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But Lord Buckley sort of, he's like, I don't know if he was even pre-beat poet, but he was one of these guys who spoke, and when he spoke, he sounded like this, and everything had a cadence, and I thought, well, whatever I find in the dictionary, it's got to have a beat to it. So I found Bifoliated Bonito. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And after I found Bifoliated Bonito, I found Couchicoidal Chelonia. And then I started to realize when I got to Daedal Doodle and Eohippus's episode that Anti-Gravity Acorn was not going to make the cut. And so then I found Apperceptive Achatina. And what happened was I let go of the Lord Buckley influence and I started looking for words that I just didn't know what they meant. And I just thought, well, this is an ABC book, and ABC books intuitively are words that kids could attach themselves to, and parents love teaching them fundamental little things, like, you know, incrementally kids learn. But my child, as soon as she learned to talk, I made her say, my daddy, I taught her, I didn't make her. Okay, she said it willingly. My daddy is a megalomaniac. Mm-hmm. And so this was before I started writing the book, and I realized that kids can say anything. They're learning everything. Their language skills are way up there, more than mine are, more than ours are. And they want their sponges, and all you have to do is show them something that is attractive, like an animation or a picture or a cartoon, and all they want to do is turn the page So the page becomes the what? The ganoid gubin. They don't know that they don't not supposed to know ganoid gubin. Only adults are supposed to know that. So my kids now at 8 and 9, I mean, they can't get candy unless they know every word in the book.
So what you're saying in essence is really that the book was prompted by your children.
A lot of my artwork has been informed by me having children.
Right.
And I worked as an illustrator for about 20 years. I stopped illustrating. And the first thing you do is say to yourself, well, what are you going to start painting? And I'm basically a painter. And as I started painting, my kids started getting born. And they became the subject matter because they're just the biggest events in my life. Shout out to Skylar and Ariel and Jim Thorpe,
shout
PA, and hello, Joan, as well. So.
And so it's interesting to me, too, the whole, what's the you're in Jim Thorpe now. You've got the restaurant gallery building center of arts incubation up there going on. At the same time, was that a crossroads, too, with moving there, the children, the book, all this?
It's
turning of a corner in a way, or new roads.
You want to make God laugh, you make a plan. I moved to Jim Thorpe, and I didn't know if I was going to wind up staying there.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was there initially, I found a studio space in a building, and it was a couple of thousand square feet, and the rent was a tenth of what I would have paid. I'm from New York.
Yeah.
This is 10 years ago, and I just thought I was a heaven. I thought I was in heaven, and I didn't have to worry about my overhead. I could just be creative. Yeah. And what happened was the building came up for sale, and I didn't want to leave my studio. Hmm. And I had the ways and means to buy a 15,000 square foot building. And that's when everything just started to like open up and present itself. You have this talent, that talent. Why don't you try to do this as far as architecture goes? Why don't you try to do this as far as ambience goes?
Mm-hmm.
Ambience architecture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're a painter.
Yeah.
You can now have your own gallery.
Right.
And it's such a big, funny question that I have a hard time putting a pinpoint on it. But it's become a destination.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We've been working on it for 8 years, and I don't own the building. The building owns me, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we noticed, of course, what's so really great about this is we went up to the, when you first opened up, we went up to the restaurant. And then we saw the ornate banister going up to
The wonderful metalwork.
Etchings in the window when we were in there, and we thought something's really great is happening here.
What's going on here?
Let's take a walk around, and we did. And of course, we stumbled into the gallery, mm-hmm. which is right next to the restaurant, and there were some exceptional, really, paintings.
www.victorstaben.com. You can see the artwork. One of the things that I had going for me when I moved to Jim Thorpe was my experience as a boy, and my dad was an inventor. He, at the age of 20, he worked at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and he made scientific instrumentation for scientists who were creating the atom bomb. And after World War II, he went into his own business where he continued to make scientific instrumentation for scientific research. So he had a big shop, and if he needed something, he went downstairs and he built it. If he needed to create something, he would do drawings on napkins, and then the napkins, gear trains on napkins, and they would turn into machines that measured molecular weights through osmotic pressures.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all this esoteric, science-y stuff that he was fabricating out of stock materials. So every time I was looking for something for the building, I would go through a catalog. I would see something that looked like a piece of junk. I would go, I can't buy this. I could make it cheaper and it'd be more beautiful. And that's what we wound up doing. So one of the things that happened was I wound up designing a lot of things. I know a tremendous, I know a handful of incredibly talented craftsmen who live in Jim Thorpe.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of speak the same language. And one of the greatest compliments I've got since I've been there by the people I've met who were construction people is that I'm very trainable. They would like me to work for them, but I'm trying to get them to work for me most of the time.
So it's been interesting to me, too, about the book. Now, the book comes along. This is a whole, not a different direction. Illustration, you're a visual artist. you had said you would describe yourself as ADD as a child, or struggling a little with language, and thus the maybe attraction to the dictionary or the playing with. Because you seem to have this relishing quality about the language.
I was told I have to shut my cell phone off, but I'd like to call my mother now. And she would tell you I wasn't just a kid with ADD, I was a nightmare. And I had poor reading skills.
Okay.
What was the question?
Well, I know I tend to do that. Forgive me. I was just going to say the language is so lush that coming from a visual arts background, which would be
I'll give you a two. My strong suit was drawing when I was a kid. I'm a left-handed person, and so the side of my brain that works is the visual side. Mm-hmm. And when I was in my early 20s, I realized that my lack of vocabulary was a hurdle. Hmm. And so what I did was I put a dictionary on a shelf in my room. I actually tilted the shelf so that the dictionary would open comfortably and I could see it comfortably. Every time I looked up a word or read a word, every time I read a word I didn't know, I looked it up. I wrote it down on the pad. Every time I listened to NPR, I was always listening to NPR or some form of public radio. Uh-huh. It's all conversation. Somebody's going to say something. I always looked it up, and I started to develop a vocabulary, like all of a sudden within about 18 months, where most of my friends couldn't understand me anymore. And I thought, oh, this is funny. And at first I thought, oh, okay, I'm sounding normal. And then I realized I got a little like paranoid. It's like, did they actually understand the use of that particular word? So I curbed my vocabulary so that it would just fit into normal parlance.
Uh-huh.
And when it came time to making the book, going back to the dictionary was just the most natural moment.
Yeah. No, not at all.
Okay. No, we're going to talk more about everything that's happening, especially we have talked about the book, and we have talked about some things that were happening. I would like to mention, and at the risk of embarrassing you, that Victor Sabin is the 2011 recipient of the Artist in Residence Grant from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, so that he may teach sessions at the Panther Valley High School. And we had talked about those things. You were talking about 70 students involved.
Well, it's funny because being an artist my whole life, I always hear stories about people getting grants. And because of my fear of paperwork, I never wanted to apply for a grant. I always felt it would be more beneficial just to look for work and get paid than go out and like try to get a grant. At the end of the day, the numbers wouldn't be as good if I just went looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
And after I made the book, because of the way I have it displayed in the building, the Allentown Art Museum found me. Because people like to eat. And they came to the restaurant and they saw the work in the galleries and they asked me to do an artist in residency. And I did one last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good. Everybody was very delighted at like the result. I have a lot of space in the 15,000 square foot building. I gave the kids a gallery and we had an opening night for the kids. What they did was they gave me 26 kids serendipitously. So each one got a letter. They read that section of the dictionary. They came up with words that they didn't know. They illustrated them. I gave them a show in the gallery. The heartwarming thing is a lot of the kids came up to me and they said, we've never been to an art gallery before.
Really?
Yeah. And I suppose that's really understandable. I think at a certain age, I had never been to an art gallery, except I lived in Manhattan. Art galleries were common.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the question again?
We have so many questions.
You're gesticulating, and I got confused.
That's right. There's too much gesticulating going on here.
Absolutely.
We'll be coming back in a moment, but we'll continue to talk a little bit more, because I know that you're going to be doing this again. There's been an educational element of this just expanding.
Okay, yes. When we come back, I'll talk about how we did it this year and how 70 kids, I went from 26 kids to 70 kids.
Yes, we shall return.
Stay tuned.
says the quadlibetical Quahog as he listens to National Public Radio, WDIY, Allentown.
WDIY reaches a well-informed and passionate listening audience every day. Enhance your image with our community by becoming an underwriting supporter. Spread the word about your business in an uncluttered atmosphere of high-quality NPR and locally produced programming. Underwriting is an affordable way to reach the public radio audience, and it may be tax deductible. To learn more, call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or visit wdiy.org.
Can we do this next week? Sorry.
This is Lehigh Valley Art Salon, WDIY in Allentown. Victor Staben is our guest, who will now most likely reveal more quirky thoughts and brilliant illustrations as we continue in this discussion of his book, of himself, and of the exhibition at the Allentown Art Museum.
So we were talking about what the program that started at Panther Valley after the Allentown Art Museum was hungry and came up and found you in the galleries or saw the work that you were doing with the alphabet. And the first group of kids, 26 kids, basically kind of paralleled what you had done with the book in a way, taking the dictionary, finding the language that excited them, coming up with characters. So this year's a little different, more involvement, more levels.
Okay, what happened this year... they asked me to come back. They gave me an additional 10 hours. So I was there for 30 hours. I showed up for 10 days, 3 hours a clip. And what happened was they gave me 26 kids who were high school age, like 16, 17-year-old children. And they read, each kid got a letter in the dictionary, came up with words they didn't know. They illustrated them. And then they gave me another 26 kids. Mm-hmm. And each one came up with, they made an illuminated letter. Like part of the book that we haven't discussed is I made my own typeface, and it was a typeface. It took me about a year to make, and it was generated from very, very detailed doodles that are kind of fanciful and hard to define, but that's why you go to www.victorstaben.com. And then they gave me 26 8 and 9 year olds.
Okay.
And the 8 and 9 year olds made narratives of the high school kids' characters. Mm-hmm. Basically, everything becomes characters. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very character driven project. And as we were working on this whole thing, we were just doing this. Okay, they have me in here, I'm doing this. Simultaneously, I have a show at the museum. And I'm looking at the work, and the work is just so good. It is really good. And I am so impressed with like the inventive ability that words present to kids, that words present to us, basically. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this would look great in the museum. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening now is all the kids, all the 26 high school kids who made the initial characters, all their work is framed. It's on a wall in the museum. And the elementary school children, they're going to be reading in front of this big grid of the high school kids' artwork, their narratives. And we're going to have a day at the museum for that. Uh-huh. And I feel like I created this little butterfly that flapped its wings and a storm appeared. Yeah. And I've showed my book to people who know books, like books, publish books, and they said, this is a nice book, Vic. I can't believe all this stuff is happening to you. And I think what's really interesting about this book is the process that went into making it. Uh-huh. And I think what's happening now is that educators are looking at it. And what it does is it teaches to the test in that kids are reading the dictionary, so they're going to do better on their SATs because maybe the dictionary is their friend. Maybe in some not too distant future, schools are giving kids the dictionary to read so they can do drawings and art classes. But the other thing it's doing is unleashing kids' imagination, which doesn't teach to the test. You teach to the test, you're worried that you're going to limit somebody's imagination. And this does both. It teaches and breaks boundaries at the same time. And it did it for me, but as an illustrator, when I went to school, some of the people that I met while I was coming up taught me the power of a single word. And in a single word, you could dance in so many different fields with new imagery. And I didn't know it was going to be something that I would put into a book and it would turn up in my backyard at Panther Valley High School. Mm-hmm. It's kind of incredible mm-hmm. that I'm launching this book through Panther Valley High School. It's going into the Allentown Art Museum, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art has mm-hmm. asked me to give That's a seminar right. on the book.
That's right.
My high school in New York City yesterday called me and asked me to be the keynote speaker to the honor kids who are graduating from the school. My school was a magnet school. It was called Art yeah. and Design. And last night at 10 o'clock, I heard that I won an Independent Book Awards Independent Publishers Award. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of like,
what's happening?
I don't know what to think. You know? I sort of thrive on criticism more than this is on you. Accolades. Yeah.
And the book was, and to go back to that for a moment, the book was literally, I mean, so you said soup to nuts, self-created, self-published. I mean, you made this book happen.
I grew the tree.
Yeah. Well.
I cut it down and made the paper.
Now, you told us about Dad and his apparatus and his work in the scientific field. And some of those things are kind of filtering into some of your drawings as well, the unique little whimsy of twists and turns of things that are happening within it. I wanted to ask you, might Skylar or Ariel, your daughters, pick up the pen and brush and continue the tradition? Or are they dancers? Or there must be some expression of art that is surfacing now in them.
They have their own gallery. They have a gallery called the Dynasty Gallery. It's in the building at Jim Thorpe. They're painters and they draw and they write and they're 8 and they're 9. Yeah, so right. I actually don't know what's going to happen with
and
them.
Joan is a writer as well, right?
Joan's a writer as well. She studied journalism and she's also written a book that we're going to self-publish pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And so it's a creative family. I think my job is to creatively be successful and set an example and mm-hmm. we'll see what happens.
It seems the book, too, though, is really kind of, I want to talk a little bit about the characters. For the radio audience, you really should go to the website. You need to see they are characters, these creatures of words. And who was in the, you said people had seen them in the gallery and started asking, well, what are their stories? They're such characters. What is the backstory in these characters? And you've started to tell us a few of those stories.
Okay, well, I have
go to Icon Magazine.
Icon Magazine. Yeah. I love Icon Magazine. Yep. It's been very, very, very good to me.
Incidentally, you're going to be...
Who said that, Sammy Sosa?
You're going to be on the cover of Icon Magazine next month, I understand.
Very, very good to me.
Very. Yeah.
What happened was, as I was creating the book, I had a room in the building where the whole room was framed out. Every page of the book had a frame that was 15 by 30, and one by one, I had... picture a room that had all frames with nothing in it, going in a grid around the room. One by one, I filled up the frames, and as I filled them up, people started realizing that I was very serious about continuing this book from A to Z. Mm-hmm. And more than once, a number of times, people said to me, well, what are their stories? These characters, what are their stories? And I just thought, I am not a writer. And I was talking to a friend of mine one night, and she said, you know, you're an artist, and artists have a particular point of view that's quirky, and very often artists can become writers because they just see things a little differently, and it translates. So what I did was I wrote the first three stories, and I also have friends who are pretty creative. And I threw it out at them, and they also started getting published in Icon Magazine. And now we're up to the letter E this month.
Things like, we have the apperceptive achatina.
Yeah, that's apperception is the mind's ability to perceive itself outside of itself. And achatina is a giant African snail.
And I know we have to wrap it up here, but I just think it's wonderful, the convention of the character Suits, they're all listening to NPR.
Oh, well...
Or the radio.
Yeah.
Okay, we're wrapping
reacting
it up,
to it.
Yeah.
Right now, I have a column that's running every month in Icon Magazine. It's mm-hmm. called Quadlibetical Moments. Mm-hmm. What happens when hybrid creatures living in surreal environments go through their daily routine with the radio on? So my characters are going through their life, listening to the radio, and it affects them, mostly with anxiety and it's a cautionary tale, and it's very, very, very funny. All the stories are true.
Great. And I wonder what comes next out of the mind of Victor Staben. Maybe mathematical figures in some form or another. We want to thank you, Victor, for being with us tonight. We're going to visit you often at Flow and at the gallery in Jim Thorpe. Again, it's
www.victorstaben.com.
Thank you again for being with us. And thank you, Bill Dondermont Smith, for making us sound so great on the radio.
That's it.
Next up on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, At the Movies, a review of a current film with Paul Willistein of the Press.
The comedy and life lessons in What to Expect When You Are Expecting are not unexpected. The romantic comedy, directed by Kirk Jones, who directed Everybody's Fine, Nanny McPhee, and Waking Ned Devine, is based on the best-selling nonfiction self-help book by Heidi Murkoff. The screenplay is by Shauna Cross, who wrote Whippet, and Heather Hash, who wrote Freaky Friday and TV's Legally Blonde the Musical. Director Kirk Jones juggles the ensemble comedy of five couples in What to Expect. That's 10, count them, 10 lead roles. There are too many lead characters, none of which is given enough screen time for each story to be told. Cameron Diaz plays Jules, a reality TV weight loss show host. Her pregnancy is a surprise to her and her partner, Evan, played by Matthew Morrison, a reality TV dance show contestant. Diaz is fine, but the role is not written to display her best comedic skills. Jennifer Lopez is Holly, a professional photographer who, with her partner Alex, played by Rodrigo Santoro, choose to adopt an Ethiopian infant. The adoption scenes in Ethiopia seem like they are from another movie. Elizabeth Banks plays Wendy, a baby breastfeeding advocate and author, and also baby supply store owner. She and her husband Gary, played by Ben Falcone, face motherhood with sincerity, believability, and humor. Brooklyn Decker is Skylar, young wife of Dennis Quaid, who is Ramsey, a NASCAR retired race car driver. They're expecting twins. Each plays their part with a mixture of brashness and brashness. Anna Kendrick is Rosie, who experiences the loss of a baby in the first trimester, along with her significant other, Marco, played by Chase Crawford. What to Expect When You Are Expecting has some hilarious scenes and some that tug at your heartstrings. Quote, "A miracle is happening inside me," unquote, says one expectant mother. Unfortunately, What to Expect is no miracle. For single persons, the movie could be a cautionary tale, or there could be another outcome. We'll see in 9 months whether there's a spike in the U.S. birth rate. What to Expect When You're Expecting is MPAA rated PG-13 for crude and sexual content, thematic elements, and language. At the box office May 18, The Avengers did it again, number one, 3 weeks in a row, with $55 million and a $457 million total. The Avengers defeated Battleship opening at number two and The Dictator opening at number three. What to Expect When You're Expecting opened at number five. Opening May 25 is Men in Black 3. The time travel plot goes back to the 1960s in the sci-fi comedy. Barry Sonnenfeld directs Will Smith, Tommy Lee Jones, and Josh Brolin. Moonrise Kingdom. Wes Anderson directs Bruce Willis, Tilda Swinton, Bill Murray, Harvey Keitel, Frances McDormand, and Jason Schwartzman in a romantic comedy about two runaways set in New England in the 1960s. Chernobyl Diaries. The horror film is about six tourists who hire a tour guide to take them to the abandoned city Pripyat, former home of Chernobyl nuclear reactor workers. Continuing at Civic Theater is Monsieur Latour. And scheduled to open at Civic Theater May 25 is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. Continue at ArtsQuest Cinema is Bully, We Have a Pope, and Marley. I'm Paul Willistein of Lehigh Valley Press at the movies for WDIY.
And you have been listening to Lehigh Valley Arts Salon on 88.1 WDIY, Lehigh Valley Community Public Radio. Time right now, 6:30 p.m. exactly, and coming up right next, Take Charge of Your Life. Current temperature, 65 degrees. Chance of showers overnight. Chance of showers continues all day tomorrow and overnight tomorrow. and moving into thunderstorms on Wednesday. This is Take Charge of Your Life.
Good evening, everyone. It's time to take charge of your